This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McGee. Projected U.S. President-elect Joe Biden is calling for more stimulus spending to help the United States recover from the coronavirus pandemic after a meeting with corporate and business leaders. The
COVID tracking project says there's a record-breaking nearly 70,000 Americans in hospitals with COVID-19, with more than 1,100 people dying every day. New Mexico's governor issued a stay-at-home order. Only grocery stores and pharmacies can be open. Philadelphia's health commissioner says indoor events are banned.
No visiting between households. No indoor weddings, funerals, baby showers.
Libraries and museums will close Friday. California's Governor Gavin Newsom's closing many non-essential businesses because of the spread.
Every age group, every demographic.
As for Thanksgiving dinner, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy.
As small as possible, because we know that indoor gatherings in homes are particularly dangerous.
The fear is that healthcare facilities will be overwhelmed with new cases and people will die because they won't be able to receive treatment. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The World Health Organization said Monday the challenge of the coronavirus was not a choice between life and livelihoods, but that they were part of the same fight. It's also said that there was no time for complacency in confronting the coronavirus, despite positive news about possible vaccines. SpaceX's newly launched capsule with four astronauts arrived at the International Space Station late Monday. The Dragon capsule pulled up and docked late Monday night following a 27-hour completely automated flight from Florida. This is the second astronaut mission for SpaceX, but it's the first time Elon Musk's company delivered a crew for a full six-month stay. The three Americans and one Japanese astronaut will remain at the orbiting lab until the replacements arrive. This is VOA News. Powerful Hurricane Iota has made landfall on Nicaragua's Caribbean coast, threatening catastrophic damage to the same part of Central America already battered by equally strong Hurricane Eta less than 2 weeks ago. Iota had intensified into an extremely dangerous Category 5 storm Monday, but the U.S. National Hurricane Center says that it weakened slightly by Monday night to a Category 4, with maximum sustained winds of 250 kilometers per hour. Iota is hitting the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua and Honduras with torrential rains and strong winds threatening catastrophic flooding in areas already saturated by Eta. Peru's Congress has chosen a new leader, expected to become the nation's third president in the span of a week, a hopeful sign that the political crisis on the verge of a resolution. Lawmakers voted overwhelmingly Monday in favor of Francisco Sagasti, an engineer from the centrist Purple Party. As the legislature's president, by law, the head of Congress should become the country's new interim president. Applause erupted in the legislative palace as Sagasti clinched the required majority vote. It was unclear how soon he might be sworn into office. A former Harvard coach and a wealthy Maryland father have been charged in a $1.5 million admission scam, AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
A former fencing coach at Harvard and a wealthy Maryland father were arrested Monday and charged with conspiracy to commit federal programs bribery. 67-year-old Peter Brand, who was fired by Harvard last year, is accused of taking $1.5 million in bribes from 61-year-old Zizek Zhao of Potomac, Maryland. In exchange, Brand allegedly helped Zhao's two sons get into Harvard as recruited fencers. Attorneys for each man deny the accusations. The case is separate from the recent college admission scandal that involved an admissions consultant getting kids into top universities with rigged test scores or fake athletic credentials. I'm Mike Gracia.
International Olympic Committee Chief Thomas Bach expressed confidence Monday that the Tokyo Games will be held successfully next year, even allowing spectators to attend as the world grapples with a sharp rise in coronavirus infections. Bach's two-day visit to Tokyo is likely to bolster Japan's efforts to stage the Olympics, but would do little to get the concerns of public deeply worried about the spread of the virus. The IOC president spent the day with the organizers discussing how to stage the massive sporting event during an unprecedented pandemic and ensure safety for a gathering of more than 11,000 international athletes. Find more at voanews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 17th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. As thousands of Ethiopians flee the conflict in the Tigray region into neighboring Sudan, analysts say that Sudan could play a key role in the conflict.
The new Sudanese government is obviously wanting to resolve its own internal issues and not get involved in any foreign issues.
That is Naba Muhaideen reporting from Khartoum. And Kenya's Ministry of Education says that schools will reopen fully in January of next year, almost 10 months since they closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Form 1, 2, and 3 learners will start their second term on the 4th of January, 2021, and end on the 19th of March, 2021. All learners except class 8 and form 4 candidates will proceed for a 7-week holiday to allow for the examination, administration, and marking.
That is Kenya's Cabinet Secretary, Professor George Magoha. And as Ugandans prepare for elections, the country's electoral body warns that it will not hesitate to suspend campaigns for politicians that violate measures put in place to prevent the spread of COVID-19. And in Rwanda, a global festival that brings together health professionals and artists to talk about mental health concludes with thousands attending virtually due to COVID-19. Those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. So stay tuned. Thousands of Ethiopians flee the Tigray conflict into neighboring Sudan. Analysts in Khartoum say that Sudan could play a key role in the conflict. Naba Muhaideen reports from Khartoum.
At least 20,000 Ethiopians have fled to Sudan since the conflict broke out in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Sudan is channeling the refugees into the eastern cities of Kadarif and Kassala and preparing camps to house them. Meanwhile, Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok says he called his Ethiopian counterpart Abiy Ahmed and said Sudan is taking an unbiased position toward the conflict. He called for African mediation to end the war and start talks between Ethiopia's federal government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Sudanese analysts believe the country has a crucial role to play due to its mutual interest with both Ethiopia and Eritrea, which was attacked by the TPLF over the weekend. African Affairs Special Researcher Ibrahim Nasser notes that Sudan once supported the Tigray region when it fought against Ethiopian dictator Mengistu Haile Mariam. Now the situation is different, he says. The new Sudanese government is obviously wanting to resolve its own internal issues and not get involved in any foreign issues. He says it's useful for Sudan to support Ethiopian stability, as its relationship with Ethiopia is a balancing component to Sudan's relations with other countries, especially Egypt. The Tigray region sits in the northernmost part of Ethiopia. The TPLF dominated national politics in Ethiopia until Abiy Ahmed from the Oromo region was elected in 2018. Abiy improved relations with Sudan by recognizing a 1979 pact that defined the Sudanese-Ethiopian border, an issue that has simmered for decades. Nasser thinks Sudan might eventually back Abiy and the federal government in the Tigray conflict. Nasser says if Sudan's national security becomes impacted by this crisis, it will definitely take a side, especially given that Abiy Ahmed has started to flirt with Khartoum's government. By resolving the border issues, that might make Sudan pragmatic due to its interest and support the federal government of Ethiopia. Abiy also played a crucial role in mediating between Sudan's military generals and civilians after the ouster of longtime Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. The mediation led to a power-sharing agreement that guides Sudan's transitional government. Meanwhile, Sudan imposed a state of emergency along the Ethiopian border last month after tribal clashes in the area killed dozens of people. Observers have voiced concern that the fragile situation in eastern Sudan, along with the Tigray conflict, could open the way for criminal networks in the region, including human traffickers. Ethiopia's government took military action against Tigray after the region's forces attacked a military camp of federal troops November 4th. According to the Prime Minister, the TPLF denied the attack. Naba Muhaideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Kenya's Ministry of Education says that schools will reopen fully in January of next year, 2021, almost 10 months since they closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. From Nairobi, Atieno Odhiambo reports that only the candidate classes were allowed to resume in October in order to prepare for the national exams.
Speaking from Nairobi yesterday, Monday, after meeting with education stakeholders, Education Cabinet Secretary Professor George Magoha said that the reopening date for the remaining classes will be 4th of January 2021 and will mark the beginning of second term, which was disrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic.
All schools will reopen fully on the 4th of January 2021. This will apply to PP1 and 2, grade 1, 2 and 3, class 5, 6 and 7, and from 1, 2 and 3 learners. 2, all 4-year-olds will join PP1 in July 2021. Number 3, pre-primary 1 and 2, grade 1, 2 and 3, class 5, 6 and 7, and from 1, 2 and 3 learners will start their second term on the 4th of January 2021 and end on the 19th of March 2021. All learners except class 8 and form 4 candidates will proceed for a 7-week holiday to allow for pre-examination, administration and marking.
Professor Magoha also urged schools to ensure that all COVID-19 protocols and the healthy safety measures have been put in place by the start of the second term in January.
I wish to assure the country that the government is determined to ensure a safe reopening and learning of our schools. In doing so, we are drawing important lessons from the partial reopening that has taken place since October. We are confident that we will remain on the right trajectory to finding the winning formula that will ensure our learning institutions are safe for our learners and teachers. The ministry appreciates the support of parents, counties and all other stakeholders and the development partners in ensuring that schools comply with all the Ministry of Health's COVID-19 safety measures.
Also speaking from the same podium, Teachers Service Commission Chief Executive Officer Nancy Masharia urged teachers who are 58 years old and above and with pre-existing health conditions to remain at home when schools resume. Mrs. Masharia also added that teachers who get infected with COVID-19 will have their medical expenses covered by insurance.
When we came here the last time, I did appeal to our teachers who are 58 and above and those who have pre-existing conditions to remain at home. But our teachers said then that the employer wanted to sack them. I want to assure our teachers that the employer is in no business of dismissing teachers, and especially when this has been a presidential directive. I wish to announce that TSC has negotiated with the teacher's medical provider for teachers to be covered for COVID-19-related diseases or illnesses.
The new dates for the full-scale reopening of schools were arrived at in a meeting between the Ministry of Education and all education stakeholders. This is after a directive by President Uhuru Kenyatta instructing Education Cabinet Secretary Professor George Magoha to review the 2021 academic calendar within 14 days. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa in Nairobi, Kenya.
A government inquiry is underway amid a public outcry after a church leader accused of various financial crimes fled South Africa after apparently bribing border officials. Self-proclaimed prophet Shepherd Bushiri had been granted bail and was expected to go on trial soon, along with his wife Mary. Darren Taylor has more.
On Saturday, Bushiri made a live appearance on his Facebook page after leaving South Africa 3 days earlier for the country of his birth, Malawi.
I am in Malawi, not running away from any trial in South Africa. If I wanted to run away, I couldn't have come to Malawi and I couldn't have announced that I'm in Malawi. Running away, you go in a country where you don't tell people where you are. I have come to seek for my government intervention.
The 37-year-old arrived in South Africa in 2015 to establish a Christian evangelical church he called the Enlightened Christian Gathering. Bushiri's charisma and outlandish, flashy style, including promises to cure disease and turn congregants into millionaires, all through God, of course, soon attracted many followers.
And according to our recent census, we have recorded about 7.8 million people who have registered online as members globally, and about 3.2 million people have registered as members in South Africa alone.
The young prophet's backstory is colorful indeed. Allegations against him include impregnating a Malawian teenager and paying her to have an abortion. when his check apparently bounced and the girl had the baby. Bushiri supposedly refused to pay support. Congregants also allege he promised massive returns on large investments with him, and they've yet to receive a cent back. Bushiri denies these allegations, suggesting they're from jealous, evil forces.
Being a young black person having success has attracted different attractions, and some of them are positive and some of them are negative.
In early 2019, the South African Priority Crimes Unit, known as the Hawks, arrested Bushiri and his wife. Investigators claim they've committed fraud and money laundering involving about $1.2 million. Bushiri says the charges are fabricated and revenge because he refused to pay bribes to senior police officers in 2017. He says he reported the attempted extortion to authorities, including South Africa's Independent Police Investigative Directorate, or IPID, but it didn't help. IPID spokesperson Ndileka Tala confirms the prophet did indeed file a complaint.
Our investigators were quite prepared to go and identify the suspect with him, but again, due to his busy schedule, he didn't avail himself. And as a result, we are still waiting for him to come back and give IPID information that is going to enable the directorate to ensure that there is no any sort of police misconduct.
Bushiri also maintains he and his wife felt forced to flee South Africa because they were convinced they'd soon be murdered there.
So many times I've had attempts of assassinations. I feel my life and my wife's life is not safe. I wouldn't want to die while my name is not cleared. In February this year, I almost got shot in Sandton at a filling station. The Sandton police, they are aware of this case. They even have a footage where my life was at a risk. I almost got shot. And until today, nothing has been done.
The police in Sandton, Johannesburg, were unable to confirm or deny Bushiri's claim. Government spokesperson Pumla Williams says the preacher must return to South Africa as soon as possible.
Whatever method that she has used to exit our shores, she has done it illegally. We started the processes as early as Saturday to make sure that we remain within the legal framework of starting the process of extradition.
She says her government has excellent relations with its counterpart in Lilongwe, so she expects Bushiri's visit, as she puts it, to Malawi to be a short one. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Uganda's electoral body is warning that it will not hesitate to suspend campaigns for politicians that violate measures put in place to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Paul Bukenya, the Electoral Commission spokesperson, says that some politicians are risking the lives of citizens by holding public rallies. But opposition politicians are blaming the Electoral Commission for not sensitizing the community. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
The campaigns for presidential and parliamentary seats kicked off a week ago in what has been described as scientific campaigns. Candidates are supposed to campaign virtually by heavily relying on both traditional and social media. The Electoral Commission also gave guidelines in which rallies should not exceed 200 people. Paul Bukenya, Uganda Electoral Commission spokesman, says politicians are not adhering to these guidelines.
This is particularly concerning, getting so many people in one place in a manner that does not provide for enforcement or implementation of the standard operating procedures, because we want to have manageable numbers and spaces where we can do social distancing, wearing of masks. So we are seeing that this is not happening in some of the the programs that are going on, including the candidates themselves not wearing masks, which exposes them to a danger, the risk of contracting COVID-19.
Patrick Oboy Amuriat, the leader of opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, and the party's presidential flag bearer, denies any wrongdoing.
The kind of reception that we encounter because of our popularity as a party is extremely good, and we are unable to control the crowds, because even as we move, people come to us. What does the Electoral Commission expect us to do?
Joel Senyun, the spokesperson of National Unity Platform Party, agrees.
Our presidential candidate, Honorable Kyagulanyi Ssentamu Robert, otherwise known as Bobi Wine, people know that this is the road he's going to use, and so they wait for him at every trading center. They clog and he waves at them and then he proceeds. These are people that come out on their own. We have not called them. We have not invited them on the roads, but they love our presidential candidate. They're hungry for change. So it's inevitable for them to come out well knowing he's going to use this route, and they wait for him, sometimes for hours.
Bukenya says those who fail to adhere to the guidelines will face the law.
One of the first things that the Electoral Commission can do and is ready to do, first of all, because we harmonize the program, we supervise the program for campaigns, is to stop the campaigns. If you're not able to go with the guidelines, then we'll definitely stop your campaign program.
Most times, the police have used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse crowds, a thing opposition says is aimed at frustrating their supporters. There are 11 presidential candidates, including the incumbent, Yoweri Tapaburwa Kaguta Museveni, who has been in power for over 30 years. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
And in Rwanda, a festival that brings together global health professionals and people in the creative industry just concluded, with thousands of people attending the event virtually due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The Hamwe Festival, organized by the University of Global Health Equity, featured discussions and performances about the role of the arts in public health. Event organizer Injonge Karangwa tells me that this year's festival explored the issue of social justice and mental health.
You know, we talk about mental health and identity and social justice. With arts, you know, there is an element of connection with the audience, with the arts, with all those performances. So that's, I would say that we had to put a lot of thinking on how do we make sure that our message goes and that our artists that are performing are reaching the audience. And we are still, it ended up yesterday, so we are still studying our audience data, but what we know already is that we reach people in more than 50 countries.
In many communities, the COVID-19 pandemic has revealed some of the long-standing systemic health and social inequities that have put many people at increased risk of getting sick and dying of COVID-19. Injonge says that it is important to study some of the non-biomedical sources of these health issues.
At the University of Global Health Equity, what we do, we aim at rethinking the way health science are taught, and also the topic of research that are done in health sector. And we believe that health problems do not only have biomedical explanations, but also have an explanation and a route and a source in political systems, social dynamics, history, perception of the self, how do I perceive myself? So all of that, we think that have to be included. There should be culture, politics, and social thinking when you're building health system. And so that's why this university have been created. And as part of our training, for example, in our medical school, the students have also courses in health financing, in political science, in anthropology, sociology, and have also exposed to initiatives like Amwe, where we are thinking about identity, the legacies of colonization, and all those things that you could have seen in the festival this year, because we think that this has an impact on health, and so should be considered when we talk about health. Basically, what we believe is that health is not only the problem of the health sector. It's also the problem of all human systems that have an impact on life, economic, politic, social, and so on.
In Malawi, female doctors led a nationwide protest against rising incidents of sexual abuse of women and girls. In their petition, The protesters gave Malawi president 30 days to put measures that would help reduce rising cases of rape and defilement, failing which they will return to the streets. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The protesters carried placards calling for the end of rising incidents of sexual abuse, rape, and defilement. Dr. Damala Opili of the Malawian Women Doctors Association led the protests in Blantyre. She told VOA that the rising number of rape and defilement referred to the hospitals forced them to hold the protests.
We are also people who are working in the hospital, and we see the heinous acts that are happening within our hospitals. These are the reported cases, so we thought we must also take a stand so that we can also stop the violence.
Piri says the statistics on sexual violence cases registered in hospitals is alarming.
Looking at the figures, it's 1 in 5 women are reporting sexual violence, whether it's defilement, rape, molestation. That's quite a high number if you think about it. And we probably have a lot more that are at home that have not been reported.
Malawi has recently registered a number of cases that have brought attention to the ongoing problem of rape and sexual abuse in Malawi. For example, last week, police in Dowa District arrested a 34-year-old man for allegedly raping 3 women who were fetching firewood at a forest. In their petition, the protesters have given Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera 30 days to put measures that would help reduce rising cases of rape and defilement. And they said if he fails to do so, they will return to the streets. Mpatso Nawena, a medical officer in Blantyre, was one of the protesters. She says Malawi should fight sexual abuse just like it is fighting COVID-19.
COVID-19, when it came to Malawi, within a week, everybody knew that there is COVID-19. And everybody knew the measures to prevent COVID-19. Everybody knew that today there is a new case. Everybody knew whatever to do to combat COVID-19. So it's the same thing with rape. We should know what to do to combat rape.
However, Malawi's Minister of Gender, Patricia Galiati, says the government is making effort to deter increased number of sexual abuse of girls and women.
We do mobilize women, girls themselves, to encourage them to report, because some of the times when they are abused, they are told not to report to anybody else, otherwise they're going to be killed. So the awareness campaign is everywhere. We've been meeting with the chiefs, we've been meeting with a number of stakeholders.
Last week, President Chakwera named a 12-member task force involving police, legal experts and rights groups aimed to help find ways to end the rising cases of rape and sexual abuse. Lameki Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that's it for this Tuesday, November 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to Ndumbulu and Makosa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.